A warm welcome to a number of distinguished guests of the actuarial profession. I'm sure most of them don't know this, but they are probably making their first visit to the home of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries. Now, the intention is that the formal proceedings will end not earlier than 6:30 and not later than 7 o'clock, and will be followed by a drinks reception, for which we must thank Towers Watson. The forum has been organised by the Events Division of the Actuarial Profession, and in particular I'd like to thank Patrina Parnell for her hard work in dealing with the logistics of this event. Now, some items of housekeeping. If the fire alarm rings, it's for real, and you should make your way to the assembly point, which is the Melton Mowbray pub. That's outside. I'm not coming back into a burning building for somebody's having a drink and not registered. I'm sure most of you know the way to the Melton Mowbray pub, but if you don't, staff will be on hand to guide you. And finally, delegates are reminded to entirely switch off mobile phones during the proceedings. Now, our speaker this afternoon is Cameron Farugi, who is a senior consultant with Towers Watson in London. He has been with that firm and its predecessor, Towers Perrin, for over 12 years. Cameron leads Towers Watson's financial reporting initiative across Europe, the Middle East and Africa, with direct responsibility for the firm's work in the areas of IFRS, EEV and MCEV. He was one of the early pioneers in giving consulting advice on the use of market-consistent valuations to help companies measure and manage risk, capital and value. He was part of the profession's embedded value working party, which advocated in its 2005 paper the market-consistent approach to allow for risk within embedded values. And last year, he chaired and co-presented at the global MCEV webinar, co-sponsored by the International Actuarial Association and the Society of Actuaries. In March this year, he presented a forerunner to tonight's paper to the International Congress of Actuaries. Of course, since March, we've seen the publication of the specification for Quiz 5, and the issue by the IASB of their long-awaited exposure draft on phase two of their insurance project. These developments have been incorporated into the paper before us this afternoon. Finally, Cameron chairs the UK Actuarial Professions IFRS Working Party, which is presenting its initial findings at a Life Convention Hot Topics session this November, and is preparing a sessional meeting paper to be presented at Staple Inn in April of next year. Now, in the context of life assurance business, the vast majority of actuaries, prudential regulators and accounting standard setters would readily accept the view that the valuation of assets and liabilities in a balance sheet should be consistent with each other, and that to achieve this and ensure objectivity, some form of market benchmark is very desirable. However, there are a number of issues of interpretation within this broad objective over which divergent views are held. Some of these are generally material to the outcome, whilst others became so during the recent financial crisis. The more important of these include the allowance for illiquidity premia, own credit risk, the exact definition of the pre-liquidity risk-free rate of interest, the treatment of day one profits, and the appropriate allowance for non-hedgeable risk. Cameron's paper covers these and a number of other technical issues, and also considers the need for disclosures to supplement the presentation of market-consistent values. It also touches upon the question of the difficult subject of pro-cyclicality. So with those few words, I'd now like to hand over to Cameron.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. May I just check, can you all hear me okay? Those at the back? Perfect. Well, thank you all for coming. I know many of you here today are very busy in your various lines of work, particularly a large number of you on Quiz 5 implementation projects. I suspect a fair number of you are now starting to grapple with the implications of the insurance contract exposure draft as well. In this presentation, I'm going to summarise the key observations and recommendations of the paper. The financial crisis that we've seen recently puts market-consistent valuation in the spotlight. And we will look at some of the commercial issues that arose, both in terms of the implementation of market-consistent valuation, also in terms of the financial crisis. And we will propose that certain technical aspects of market-consistent valuations be revisited. But first, let's not forget that both accounting standards and solvency regulations are moving to a market-consistent approach. So where are we going with Solvency II, and how does market-consistent valuation fit in? Well, the framework directive was finalised late last year. And the directive states early on that one of the key drivers for changing the solvency regime in Europe is to use an economic risk-based approach so that companies properly measure and manage risks. And this is achieved by requiring companies to calculate a balance sheet to work out own funds on the left-hand side. Own funds is a Solvency II terminology, which is a similar concept to the available capital or the market-consistent embedded value. The difference between assets and liabilities. And these assets and liabilities are calculated as amounts to be exchanged or transferred between knowledgeable, willing parties. And then this balance sheet is stressed to work out the solvency capital requirement. So in other words, in principle, companies should be using a realistic, market-consistent, best estimate approach to calculate the Solvency II balance sheet, and all the allowance of prudence should lie in the solvency capital requirements. And I think most of us would be pretty happy if Solvency II ended up following this principle. However, Level 2 implementing measures appear to be heading in a prescriptive and somewhat different direction. My fear is that certain elements of Level 2 may be introducing prudence into the basic balance sheet through the back door. Some of it is observable now. Some will become obvious during the next financial crisis. And I'll identify a few specific areas of concern later, based in part on the July Quiz 5 specification. Just to state the obvious, if we do not get the calculation of the basic balance sheet right, the left-hand side, we will not be getting the solvency capital requirement right either. The model to calculate the capital requirement relies on the sensible starting point. The objectives behind the whole framework may start to break down. Moving to IFRS, we can see the foundations of the market-consistent approach underpinning latest IASB Phase 2 insurance contracts developments. The exposure draft, just came out in late July, states that one of the key aims is to provide relevant information to users for economic decision-making. And how does the exposure draft achieve this aim? By proposing a building block approach, the middle column, where the best estimate liability, the first building block, is a discounted value of future cash flows calculated using methods and assumptions consistent with current and observable market prices. In other words, a market-consistent approach to the valuation of the liability. Other building blocks include a risk adjustment, I'll come back to that later, and a residual margin, which is a plug to ensure that on day one of selling a contract, no profit is shown. The liability equals the present value of the premiums. Now, certain acquisition costs fall outside this calculation, guaranteeing a new business loss on day one. Now, this whole structure is designed, on the one hand, to ensure that insurance liabilities are calculated using a market-consistent approach. On the other hand, to ensure this overall framework fits in with other IFRS accounting developments, which tend to restrict or prohibit a day one profit. So overall, the calculations underlying future accounting solvency will both be based on a market-consistent approach. And this follows a trend we have already seen in the last 10 years or so in embedded values and individual countries' regulations. So why this trend? This paper reminds us why we made the move to market consistency in the first place, why it is preferred to non-market consistent measures. First, the market consistent framework allows decision makers to assess the relative merits of different courses of action and make better decisions. It is more objective. The calibration of the allowance for market and credit risk, where reliable, is taken out of the hands of actuaries and management, restricting their ability to smooth results, holding back hidden margins in the good years, only to release them in the poor years. It's easier to achieve consistency, in principle, and consistency can mean different things. By calibrating the valuation to market prices where reliable, we should achieve better consistency of the asset and liability side of the balance sheet. We should achieve better consistency over time and better consistency in the comparison of values between different blocks of business or companies. There's a clear link to ALM investment strategies. By benchmarking the calibration with a low-risk calibration asset, the market consistent value tells you the estimated cost of choosing that low-risk strategy. And if you choose to mismatch, as most companies do to one degree or another, it helps you assess the risk distribution around the expected return. Now, these advantages are as relevant today as they have always been. But the financial crisis has highlighted some important commercial challenges. Some companies using market-consistent techniques have exhibited far more volatility in their results than those who use smoother traditional techniques. So to what extent does this represent weaknesses with evaluation method or the impact of real asset liability mismatches on the balance sheet? There is a macroeconomic risk that a market-consistent solvency framework can lead to procyclicality. Market values fall at times of financial crisis, and this can threaten insurers' solvency. In order to protect solvency, insurers may sell higher-risk assets to fund the purchases of lower-risk assets, leading to further market falls, again further threatening solvency. Other macroeconomic effects also exist. For example, what happens if you apply market-consistent techniques in pricing but operate in a market where other participants do not apply them? For investment-related products, the market-consistent measure will tell you to harden prices as the market price of risk goes up. But other traditional measures tend to be smoother and encourage you to hold prices steady for longer. Those applying the market-consistent measure seem to only have two options: to sell business at a loss or to lose market share. And neither option seems appealing. And finally, any value-based measure does not tell you what you need to know about the capital. What is the capital generated by the in-force business? What is the capital strain of the new business? Will you be able to maintain dividends? And these are all critical questions in the current world. So what to do? I believe that these issues can be addressed in part by designing a wider reporting pack. And here are some of the metrics that the paper describes. Looking at balance sheet, earnings, the impact of writing new business and sensitivities on your Solvency II regulatory reporting basis. Looking at it on your IFRS basis. Also, if either one of the first two is not sufficiently realistic, looking at a more realistic measure of value, market consistent and better values perhaps. In terms of the cash flow and capital, looking at distributable earnings, your expected distributable earnings on a real world basis. What is your expected return on the capital you're investing? Once you have a pattern of expected distributable earnings, you can then work out an implied discount rate that gets you back to the market consistent value. You can start looking at sensitivities if you decide you have a different risk tolerance than that implied by the market consistent value. Also, net fund flows. What's happening to the assets on the balance sheet, particularly for the product lines where your income is being driven by annual management charges or similar. In terms of new business, you know, split by product type, what sort of volumes are you selling? What's the initial strain on your products? What's the internal rate of return, the expected return to the capital provider for providing the initial strain capital? And what's the payback period, the expected rate, speed with which the capital is returned? But with all these new metrics come new responsibilities, the need to understand how to use the information to make decisions, and the need to avoid snap decisions based on volatile numbers, and to balance both short-term and long-term considerations. And these responsibilities lie with internal users, directors, senior managers, actuaries, accountants, and they also lie with external users, the capital providers, the analysts, and the regulators. So let's revisit the technical issues and take some lessons from the financial crisis. In the last couple of years, where has a market consistent model worked well, and where has it been found wanting? And the paper covers these topics over here. And in this presentation, I'm going to cover some key points on each. First, the overall allowance for risk. There are conceptual questions around what exactly do we mean by market consistent valuation? What are we trying to achieve, and how are we calibrating the allowance for risk? Do we think that assets and liabilities should be valued completely separately? Do we use what I call the transfer value or current exit value approach to valuation? In other words, how much would I get if I sold these assets over here in the open market? How much would I have to pay to get a third party to take on my liabilities over there? This underlies a Solvency II basis evaluation. It's set out in the framework directive, and there are important implications for the detailed calibration. This was also the model put forward by the IASB in 2007 in an insurance contracts discussion paper, the current exit value approach. But interestingly, not in the latest insurance contracts exposure draft. The IASB listened to industry feedback and has instead put forward a fulfillment or going concern basis. Going back to current exit value or transfer value, straight away you hit on a calibration issue. How do you calibrate the transfer value of liabilities? Perhaps you should use the mergers and acquisition market as a guide. But M&A deals are not about selling liabilities to other companies, but selling blocks of business, assets and liabilities together, in a commercial world where all manner of different considerations apply. So what does this transfer value of liabilities concept mean? It seems pretty theoretical and nebulous to me. And instead, I propose something more simple and I think more useful. Going back to basics, the nature of an insurance business model is to get premiums from policyholders, invest the premiums in assets, and hold those assets to back the liabilities to meet claims as they fall due. So let's use a philosophy that's concerned with blocks of business as a whole, not assets and liabilities separately, and that looks at going concern value and not transfer value. I believe this would be a more meaningful model, and by applying this model, it would be easier to achieve consistency in the valuation between the assets and liabilities, a theme I'll be coming back to several times later. So moving on to asset valuation developments. Simple, right? Just use market value of assets. But in the midst of a financial crisis, this is not so easy. And one development I think should be of enormous interest to insurers, it should be of interest, is a fair value measurement project developed by both the IASB and FASB. The IASB published a fair value exposure draft in May 2009, and similar in many areas to amendments to the FASB FAS 157 fair value standard. And this exposure draft defines the core principle of fair value to be the price to be received to sell an asset or transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants at the measurement date. So how do you determine whether a transaction is orderly? Well, there are 9 criteria set out in the exposure draft to help answer this question. And several of these relate to the depth and liquidity question insurers have already had to face when selecting the calibration asset used in the market consistent value of liabilities. So perhaps the insurance industry can learn from the guidance in this exposure draft. But what do we do if a transaction is deemed to be disorderly? Well, the question is simple if you can't observe any prices out there at all. The draft directs you to use a mark-to-model approach where you should be taking into account all the orderly prices that are out there that are relevant to the valuation of that particular instrument to try and estimate what value your asset would have if its market were orderly. Life gets a bit more tricky when you can see a market price, but all the signs are there that that specific market is exhibiting disorderly behavior. And here's where judgment is needed to decide whether the observed market price represents an orderly transaction. Again, the mark-to-model approach is encouraged in the exposure draft to assess how reasonable the observed market value may be. And I think this is the area which is a huge issue for the insurance industry in a financial crisis such as we had at the end of 2008, where many markets literally dried up in a very short space of time. And at that time, I don't think the insurance industry was geared up properly to recognize the need for or apply such judgment. Let's be honest, we were all in crisis management mode. And there was a real reluctance to make any changes to the market prices on the asset side of the balance sheet. Instead, companies were using all the tools at their disposal on the liability side to make adjustments. And unless we work hard to develop best practices to solve this problem, I don't think we'll be geared up very well for the next financial crisis. Unfortunately, I see little evidence that Solvency II developments will help. There is virtually no discussion on this point in the Quiz 5 specification. There are 90 pages discussing how to value the liabilities, plus a myriad of accompanying papers and appendices. And these include various discussions about how to value liabilities when the calibration asset is no longer deep and liquid. Unfortunately, little or none of the content seems to relate back to how to value assets in liquid markets. And I think there's a real danger we will end up with a framework in Solvency II where decisions being made to allow for a liquid market are not consistent between the asset and liability side of the balance sheet. A final question. Do you calibrate to the mid or the bid price? At year-end 2008, we saw bid-ask spreads shooting up for many financial instruments, from around 10 to 20 bips to between 50 and 100 bips. And that had a significant impact on the balance sheet. Currently, IAS 39, financial instruments, allows a mid-price to be used where you are applying fair value to both asset and liability sides of the balance sheet, and the assets are being held to match the liabilities. But not where IFRS 4 insurance contract applies. Where assets are being held to match insurance contract liabilities, I believe insurance companies should be able to use mid-prices in valuing financial instruments where the market and credit risk broadly offset between the assets and the insurance contract liabilities. I think that would be very good news for the industry, removing a pro-cyclical weakness with current IFRS. Now, some of the IASB pronouncements suggest that future fair value may become more flexible in this area, but it is not clear. Others seem to suggest that, again, will only apply where fair value is being applied on both sides of the balance sheet. So moving on, what do we calibrate the reference rate to in the valuation of liabilities? Now, this was never an easy question to answer, but it certainly got much more difficult since the financial crisis began. Well, I put up here are graphs from the UK showing yields on gilts, UK government bonds in red, swaps in black or blue, depending on how you see it, and also AA corporate bonds from end 2006 to end 2009. And similar patterns such as these are observable in other currencies. One interesting observation is that government bonds and swaps recently started to cross over for a number of reasons. One is credit risk related. There are rolling credit checks operating in the swaps market, which effectively reduce the level of credit risk, particularly after years one or two. But two are not credit risk related, the funding premium. A company having to buy a government bond will have to fund it fully in cash. A company entering a swaps arrangement will only have to part fund it in cash. And also, there is evidence that there was a real lack of arbitrageurs willing to operate in this market following the financial crisis. Arbitrageurs used to operate and help keep government bonds and swaps closely together. So this does suggest that the calibration to swaps with no amendment would have been too harsh in the latest financial crisis. But more generally, what are the key issues to think about when calibrating the reference rate? Well, the trend within all of MCEV, Solvency II, and IFRS Phase 2 is to use a risk-free rate plus a liquidity premium for illiquid liabilities. Solvency II Level 2 implementing measure proposals that the reference rate, otherwise known as risk-free rate, should be 100% credit risk-free. But 100% credit risk-free rate can only be a theoretical concept, particularly at times of financial crisis where the long-term viability of banks and governments starts to become questioning. In practice, in Quiz 5, we have seen a 10 basis point deduction to swaps for credit risk. And when you're at that level, it makes you wonder, why bother? I prefer to identify a suitable low-risk calibration asset that matches the liabilities well and calibrate to that yield without adjustment, to accept that the small level of credit risk within that calibration asset is being capitalized in the valuation. Remember, insurance company liabilities are also not 100% credit risk-free. And I think swaps fall into this category due to the collateralization and rolling credit check arrangements. Government bonds, I think, generally fall into this category where countries control their own money supply, but not in common currency areas such as the Eurozone, where there is clear decoupling risk. And we've seen the fallout recently in Greece. But I do think this rules out using a high-quality corporate bond yield in the valuation of insurance contract liabilities. Now, such a yield is used in pension scheme valuations. But if you're not holding corporate bonds to match your liabilities and you use a corporate bond yield as a discount rate, then you can see strange movements in net equity during a financial crisis. There's effectively an accounting mismatch being introduced. And that's why we saw many pension scheme funds move into surplus at year end 2008, and then subsequently move back into deficit at interim or year end 2009. There was a clear lag effect in recognizing the impact of the financial crisis. And interestingly, we did not see that sort of problem with market consistent embedded values. But corporate bond spreads went through the roof during the financial crisis, whereas actual defaults did not. If some of this increase in spread is attributable to increased corporate bond liquidity and insurance companies are not forced sellers, then surely an insurance company could justify the capitalization of some of this increase in risk premium. Well, I prefer to look at this in two parts. First, what level of liquidity premium can we find in the more illiquid markets such as corporate bonds? And second, how much of that liquidity premium would it be reasonable to allocate in the valuation? Now, in terms of the first question, one way of measuring the liquidity premium in the corporate bond market is a residual spread approach. The excess of an index corporate bond yield over a swap yield over the market price of credit risk as determined, say, by an index credit default swap. This is my preferred approach for Eurozone and US dollar, but it does contain weaknesses. Indices are not available in other currencies. Company credit default swaps do not always exist. Now, the CFO and CRO forums have been very busy in the last year looking closely at this method and two other approaches as well, the covered bond market and the output of a Merton-style model. And they've concluded that the following proxy formula, looking at the spread of corporate bonds over swaps, deducting 40 basis points and taking 50%, that proxy formula works well based on evidence of the past few years. So let's take a look at how the formula compares to the residual spread approach. And what we have here on this chart is a residual spread approach for Eurozone and US dollar in red, Eurozone in yellow, and then a few dots showing the CFO-CRO formula at selected valuation dates. And I think the formula compares fairly well to the residual spread approach pre and post financial crisis, but does seem to introduce some prudence in the midst of the financial crisis cover. So perhaps both the 40 basis points and the 50% level in the formula could be a bit higher to calibrate better to financial crisis conditions. But let's not forget the formula is simple and it will encourage the industry to be united on this front. And I do like the structure of the formula. And to be united is important in discussion with the regulators. But that's only step one, how much liquidity premium is there in the corporate bond market. What about the next step, how much is reasonable to use in evaluation? And this is where I think much work remains to be done. One approach is to restrict the corporate bond liquidity premium based solely on the features of the liabilities. To what extent are the liabilities made up of stable and predictable cash flows resembling an illiquid fixed interest asset? And this is the trend within the Solvency II Liquidity Premium Task Force report that came out in March of this year, Quiz 5 that came out the final spec in July of this year, and the approach mirrors decisions taken in the Phase 2 project, the description in the exposure draft. I think this approach works fairly well where markets remain open, such as before the recent financial crisis or since the summer of 2009. But don't forget, the nature of an insurance business model is to get premiums from policyholders, invest in assets, and hold the assets to back the liabilities. I think a liquidity premium can only be earned by an insurer in practice by thinking of the liabilities, the assets, and the ALM investment strategy together. And this is where I fear Solvency II and Phase II are both introducing an accounting mismatch, perhaps driven by some who want to make life easy for themselves and not worry too much about whether the numbers are meaningful, as well as those who have been reading too much financial economics theory, which states that the market consistent value of liabilities, if the liabilities themselves do not depend on the assets, then the value should also be independent of the assets held. And I think that theory works well in normal times. It relies on the efficient market hypothesis. But unfortunately, that hypothesis goes out the window in the midst of a financial crisis. Don't forget, in a year-end 2008 environment, if the illiquid markets all dried up and you didn't already hold the assets, then I beg the question, how could you have captured the liquidity premium in practice? We're back to the pension scheme valuation problem of companies' equity going up at times of crisis because of accounting mismatches. I think critical from a risk management perspective is whether there is a viable investment strategy available to the insurer to enable the liquidity premium to be captured. And that is why, on top of liability-driven restrictions, I think you also need to consider asset and ALM aspects to judge a sensible level to capitalize in the market-consistent valuation, to introduce further restrictions to the liquidity premium in certain circumstances. Now, interestingly, the Solvency II Task Force report, Principle 3, talks about the not exceeding the extra return which can be earned by the insurer holding a liquid asset free of credit risk and available in the markets. And this was echoed by the CFO-CRO forum paper that backed CRIS 5 specification. But how can this Principle 3 and Principle 2, further up, both be met in a dried-up market such as N2008 if you do not already own the assets? The paper does not elaborate, and this principle seems to have been forgotten about in the CRIS 5 specification. But don't forget, CRIS 5 covered year-end 2009, and CRIS 4 covered year-end 2007, and neither formally covered year-end 2008. And so for those of you working on Solvency II projects, I suggest you try and apply the CRIS 5 approach to the year-end 2008 valuation as well. And you'll realize that certain aspects of the instructions are difficult to interpret in the year-end 2008 environment. So while the formula we saw earlier may be introducing some prudence in the midst of a financial crisis, I think this approach at the top we may well see in future in allocating liquidity premium in the valuation may well be optimistic in a financial crisis. And it'll be pure luck if the two offset. So what about the calibration of stochastic models? Just to recap, implied volatility is the wrong parameter in the wrong model to get the right price. What do I mean by that? When you want to go and buy a standard traded option, you'll see an implied volatility quoted. In order to work out what price the market maker is actually offering, you need to go to a standard option pricing model, Black-Scholes or Black's, stick that volatility in, stick in a swap yield curve, and see what price comes out. That is the price of the option in the market. I see a lot of discussion which forgets what implied volatility represents. It's just a tool to quote a price, nothing more. And that's why I think the various adjustments we saw in the midst of the last financial crisis, averaging implied volatility over a year, forgetting about the implied volatility at the valuation date and going back a few months, pre-financial crisis, I thought they were based on flawed logic. Now, interestingly, market-consistent embedded values, companies went back to using unadjusted implied volatilities at year-end 2009. Was that based on changes in their views of the logic, or is that based on implied volatilities coming back down again? How would companies behave now if the financial crisis were to repeat itself? Nothing in the public domain suggests to me that a credible approach has been developed in this area in anticipation of the next financial crisis, particularly at an industry level. In terms of the CRIS 5 specification, there is a discussion about whether to use implied volatility or historic volatility, and it suggests using implied volatility when the calibration instruments are deep and liquid, otherwise considering historic volatilities in the calibration found in one of the appendices. But there's a separate section of CRIS 5 on the calibration of the economic scenario generator, which states that the ESG should reproduce the market prices of options, pointing towards using implied volatilities. But CRIS 5 does not consider the fair value in the liquid markets developments in this context. I think the industry should be thinking about liability option valuations in the context of the fair value measurement proposals, using unadjusted market prices where option markets remain deep and liquid, and considering what an orderly option price may be in more extreme markets. In this way, maintaining consistency between the asset and liability valuations. And I think moving to the bottom bullet on the left-hand side, there is also a case for allowing for a liquidity premium for a block of business with embedded options and guarantees, but only for the non-option cash flows, not for the option cash flows. The nature of optionality means that we cannot capture liquidity premium in assets backing option cash flows. No such assets exist. Now, there are other reasons you will hear for moving away from market prices of options, which I have less sympathy with on the right-hand side. Top one, removing credit risk from market prices. The theory goes that the options themselves have some credit risk, and so however high that market price of the option is, we should really be calibrating to something higher, removing the credit risk. And this, in my mind, goes back to the arguments about the reference rate. Options, yes, have some credit risk in them. It's pretty small. And let's not forget, insurance liabilities are also not 100% credit risk free. I prefer leaving the traded option prices unadjusted in that context, not introducing extra prudence. But some of these other reasons. My economic scenario generator cannot handle high prices, so I'm going to use lower volatilities to actually allow the generator to run. Option prices this year are much higher than last year, so therefore, actually, I'd rather go back to last year's prices. Or just historic volatilities feel better to me. I don't think those sorts of reasons stack up on their own in a market-consistent valuation. What we're basically saying is we don't like market-consistent values of options. We want to move away from them. Moving on to non-hedgeable risk. This table compares and contrasts Solvency II and Phase II. Solvency talks about a risk margin. Phase II talks about a risk adjustment. Some similarities in their concepts. Solvency II, the description on the top left, is really all about making sure that the technical provision gets back to a current exit value. From the perspective of an outside user, how much would an outside user need, would you need to give them to take on your liability? Phase two, interestingly, is starting to introduce a similar current exit value concept here, even though its principle elsewhere is fulfillment value, but from the point of view of the insurer. How much would the insurer rationally pay to get someone else to take on the liability? So a fair amount of overlapping principles, but two different perspectives, the inside company or the outside user. In terms of measurement technique, Solvency II, Quiz 5, and Direction of Level 2 implementing measures appears to go for a cost of capital approach. In fact, the cost of capital, I think, is prescribed in the Framework Directive. Quiz 5 specifies the rate of capital. Phase 2 allows one of three methods, cost of capital, confidence level, or conditional tail expectation. It has more flexibility in this area. That's good news for European insurers, because they'll have to be getting cost of capital under Solvency II, so they'll be able to just apply the same technique under Phase 2. But those insurers publishing under IFRS will also have to apply a confidence level technique to disclose the equivalent confidence level. That's one of the requirements of the exposure draft to allow companies to be comparable across the world. Now, interestingly, the MCV principles come from a different perspective entirely in this area. They call this adjustment a cost of residual non-hedgeable risk. And they recognize that there may be a need to apply a charge for uncertainty. They leave it open about what the purpose of that would be. But certainly, they prescribe that this bucket has to include an allowance for risks not allowed for elsewhere in the valuation. Now, when thinking about that, I think there are two key things to think about. First of all, the calibration. Quiz 5 has calibrated a 6% level. In fact, SIOPS wants at least 6%, potentially something higher. Where is this 6% coming from? This is becoming a big number for many insurance companies. Unfortunately, I've never seen a credible story backing the 6%. I've seen SIOPS referring to the fact that this is being used by the Swiss Solvency Test, so it must be okay. Appendix D of the Swiss Solvency Test, drafted about 7 or 8 years ago, talks about it being a weighted average cost of capital calibration. But unfortunately, the regulators do not seem to realize that the WACC is primarily a market risk measure. We're allowing for all the market risk directly in the calculation, so much of the 6% may well be double counting. The second problem, there isn't enough guidance to really tell whether Solvency II or Phase II levels will be comparable between companies. Will this end up being a charge for uncertainty, or an allowance for risks not allowed for elsewhere, or a bit of both? I suspect a bit of both. And if we're not careful with disclosures, no one will really be sure how the mix splits by company or for the industry as a whole. So what should companies be doing? Well, I think companies should be undergoing a risk management process to identify what risks are being allowed for where in the valuation, and then assessing to what extent the risk margin in Solvency II, the risk adjustment in Phase II, or the cost of residual non-hedgeable risk in MCEV allows for these risks, or whether they are being allowed for more directly elsewhere. And this is the six-step process that we introduced when the MCEV principles came along, and actually a number of companies have already been following under Solvency II. And there's nothing to stop them thinking in a similar way under Phase II. And the first five steps are all about trying to identify risks which may or may not be allowed for directly elsewhere, and then deciding for those risks, if they're not being allowed for elsewhere, do we want to make an explicit adjustment elsewhere in the valuation, or do we want to allow for them in the risk margin or risk adjustment? Only the last step is a pure allowance for uncertainty. And the paper goes on to describe the sorts of things that you could find under each of these steps. But I've seen some unintended consequences, I suspect unintended, of PSYOPs pushing for a large risk margin. I've seen people in Solvency II projects realize they have discretion in a number of areas, such as extreme operational risk. There's nothing to stop them deciding whether to allow for it in the best estimate or whether to allow for it in the risk margin. And so companies, having been forced to apply a large risk margin, in my view, 6%, are deciding, well, we might as well stick a lot of things in that bucket and not allow for them in the best estimate liability. So that the overall might be fairly sensible, but you are giving the perception to the outside world that you're probably, if anything, being a little prudent, and you're following the rules. Perhaps we will see similar unintended consequences in phase two if companies decide to similarly end up with large risk adjustments. Moving on to the allowance for own credit risk. What I've done here is lifted some wording from Article 75 of the Framework Directive in the box. And it starts very sensibly. It talks about liabilities valued for the amount which they could be transferred or settled between knowledgeable willing parties in an arm's length transaction. I particularly like the end of that phrase, knowledgeable willing parties in an arm's length transaction, implying go for something realistic and use a lot of common sense. And then suddenly there's this paragraph we find straight after it. When valuing liabilities under this point B, no adjustment to take account of the own credit standing of the insurance or reinsurance undertaking shall be made. And on its own, it seems to be implying that you shouldn't have any own credit risk whatsoever in any of your liabilities in your balance sheet, not just insurance liabilities, but all the other sorts of liabilities, corporate debt or pension scheme or so on. But it's not quite clear if that's the right interpretation, because it doesn't actually say adjustment to what. You could argue it's no adjustment to market prices or no adjustment to fair value. And then the paragraph seems to just go away. Now, just moving across to ISB phase two for a minute. And ISB more generally published a credit risk and liability discussion paper last year. And this year, in terms of its rulings under fair value for liabilities, confirmed its previous stance that own credit risk has a role to play in the measurement of liabilities. And FASB has a similar view. That's more generally in liabilities. But the phase two exposure draft talks in paragraph 38 about how the present value of the fulfillment cash flows shall not reflect the risk of non-performance by the insurer, either at initial recognition or subsequently. Now, I agree there should be some stringent limits to allowing for own credit risk and insurance liability. After all, there are many reasons why you'd expect it in normal times to be a very small amount. But there are consequences of not allowing any own credit risk in the liability valuation. You introduce procyclicality. If you restrict it in the solvency, you certainly introduce procyclicality. So what you could instead allow for is any material risk to be in the capital requirements and not the accounting, particularly at times of financial crisis. I think there is a case for allowing for some own credit risk in a financial crisis. And I talked earlier about why don't we just leave these calibration assets unadjusted. It doesn't matter if government bonds or swaps become a little riskier in the year-end 2008 environment. We can leave them unadjusted in evaluation. If we're that concerned about those specific assets, we can allow for it in the capital requirements. Now, quiz five, interestingly, almost copies this framework directive word for word and then suddenly sticks in the word subsequent before adjustment. So it suddenly becomes no subsequent adjustment to take account of own credit standing. And perhaps this has been done to justify the stance it has taken in the valuation of corporate debt. Moving on to the valuation of other assets and liabilities. Now, sticking to the left-hand side, IFRS, insurance companies typically value corporate debt, and this is their own debt on their balance sheet, at either amortized cost or fair value. Well, quiz five introduces a new valuation for corporate debt. You use entry value on day one, which helps ensure that there is no profit or loss on day one, but then subsequently you allow for changes in risk-free rates. So effectively you lock in the day one credit risk. What do you mean by risk-free rates in this context? Does it include liquidity premium? The Quiz 5 specification itself is not clear. And this, I think, introduces some procyclicality in the solvency. In the midst of a financial crisis, you are being forced to apply a much more prudent value in your valuation of corporate debt than fair value, almost incentivizing you to buy back your debt just to improve your solvency position. You could have allowed for that risk in the capital requirements. But more generally, there are other oddities with aspects of the valuation of other assets and liabilities. Looking at the pension scheme, Quiz 5 says quite clearly use the IAS 19 basis. Well, this forces companies to use a high-quality corporate debt yield to discount pension liabilities in both the main balance sheet and the SCR credit stress. Now, we discussed already how this leads to obvious results in the midst of a financial crisis where significant pension surpluses can arise. But we now have three different interpretations of the phrase no adjustment to take account of own credit standing, all found in Quiz 5. One for technical provisions, make a deduction to swap yield curves. One for corporate bonds, lock in the amount of credit risk on day one. And one for pension scheme liabilities. It doesn't matter, allow for credit risk, use your high quality corporate bond yield. So which direction is Solvency II going to go? I'm not sure. But finally, the valuation of tax assets and liabilities. One of the oldest international accounting standards, IAS 12, has rules that bear no resemblance to what we are used to in market-consistent valuations today. IAS 12 covers both deferred tax assets and deferred tax liabilities. It talks about not permitting any discounting because it reasons that the future cash flows themselves are uncertain, so why would we want to discount them? It talks about only creating a deferred tax asset or liability if the likelihood of the asset or liability to arise is greater than 50% probable, introducing a restriction to the valuation of the asset or liability. Now, that second aspect may well be is proposed to be amended in future IAS 12. These features of IAS 12 are in no way consistent with the concept of market-consistent valuation, the concept of discounted cash flow. And these affect different companies in different ways, depending on their tax position. Now, for some reason, Quiz 5 directs the user to follow this standard without amendment. And this creates an inconsistency with the rest of the valuation. Now, that's all I'm going to say on the technical issues, but a few thoughts for you to perhaps think about and feedback in your Quiz 5 submissions. But before we move on to your comments and questions, I'd like to leave one last question for us all to think about. What sort of valuation metric do we want? Different metrics encourage different behaviors. Do we want to return to the 20th century, where in a downturn, insurance companies were encouraged by the regulatory rules to sell their lower risk assets and buy higher risk assets in order to get a higher valuation interest rate, somehow creating regulatory value and protecting solvency? Do we want to stick to the market consistent method developed in the noughties? What happens when asset markets dry up and bid-ask spreads explode? When swap yields become lower than government bonds? Does the financial crisis lead to some accidental prudence? And does this trigger pro-cyclicality? Has Solvency II failed so far to address these issues? Or do we want to recognize where market efficiencies break down at times of financial crisis and insert some limited and defendable mitigating features to encourage insurance companies to exercise judgment in the asset valuation when markets dry up, to allow insurance companies to take advantage of market inefficiencies in the valuation, where given their business model, they're well placed to take advantage in practice? And I believe that these amendments will help maintain the link with ALM, the improved objectivity of market consistent valuation, the improved consistency, while introducing more financial stability than we've seen so far. So what do you think? Thank you.
The event open to comments from the floor. But before I do that, first of all, I must let you know, if you're thinking of speaking, that the proceedings are being recorded and will be put on the Actuarial Professions website, but not published in the BAJ. So if you're thinking of speaking, bear that in mind. Can people who, I've been given a list of some names who want to say something, but can everybody, including them, put their hand up if they think they might want to speak so I can judge whether we need to curtail contributions from the floor? So could you put your hands up, please? Okay, well, I don't think, I think we don't need to curtail our contributions, but that, I hope, doesn't give carte blanche for inordinately long ones. So can I ask Peter Needleman to kick the contributions off, please?
Thank you. Yeah, just wanted to make a few comments, I guess a bit of a plea, probably too late and maybe falling on deaf ears. But first of all, thanks, Cameron, for a very interesting and detailed paper. And I think it's very helpful to have consolidated in one place most of the issues that the industry is grappling with at the current time in relation to both financial and and regulatory reporting, and also to hear your views on the best way of dealing with some of these issues. I think as we all now understand, the life sector is one in which investors are really struggling to understand our business. And clearly anything that can be done as we go forward to simplify financial reporting is going to be very warmly welcomed. I'd like to think it shouldn't be that complicated to deal with these issues, but somehow we do seem to find ways to make it complicated. But having said that, we do have to recognise, and I think investors and analysts have to recognise, that with contracts that have complex guarantees that stretch out over 25 years or more, and in the sort of current environment, very low interest rates and very volatile market conditions, that any attempt to measure insurance liabilities, whether for regulatory reporting or any other purpose, is going to be fraught with difficulties. We're just not going to get away with that. And the results are always going to be very sensitive to even very small differences in methodology and assumptions. So I think, you know, it is important, and Cameron highlighted, you know, you really need to look at the differences that some of these small differences in, or perceived small differences in approaches can make in very stressed conditions like in 2008. So for us, even simple questions like, you know, are our products profitable, or have I really set aside enough assets to meet expected claims? These are not going to be easy to answer, certainly for some contracts. And the reality is that the truthful answer to those questions is only going to be known for certain when the last policy goes off the books. So in the meantime, all we can do is to make our best estimates according to certain methodologies and keep adjusting them as experience unwinds. But in the meantime, as our rules for both regulatory and financial reporting are developing, currently it appears that we are going to be stuck with three different approaches, one for calculating the solvency reserves, one for the accounting provisions, and one for estimates of the market consistent or economic value of the business. And my point is really that surely we should be able to arrive at a common starting point for all of these that should be the same. And in my own opinion, that should be the fair value of the liabilities on a fulfillment value basis, effectively a realistic accounting provision. So that would give us the best estimate of the value of the future profits for a contract. And then when we see, you know, under accounting rules that, for example, we don't want to recognise, accountants don't want to recognise the profits up front, then the pace of emergence of that profit, the release or the recognition of it over the life of the contract, can then be defined through the rules around the release of the risk margin. So, but you're still working from a consistent base. The net worth before adjustment of any deferral of those profits would then be the best estimate of the fair value of the business, equivalent to an MCEV. And then we would only need supplementary value-based reporting, which would be limited to the estimates of the value added by new business, probably on both a market consistent and a real-world basis, and of course various sensitivities to the assumptions, to certain key assumptions. And in addition, of course, we are going to need to see capital-based metrics, including cash flows and distributable earnings on a real-world basis, as we've seen, cash is king, particularly in stressed conditions. So in this ideal world, The technical provisions for solvency purposes would simply be the realistic accounting provisions, and then for solvency purposes, all the prudence would be included in the capital requirements. I mean, really, apart from the accounting profit recognition and perhaps for tax purposes, does it really matter exactly what the technical provisions are? What really matters from a regulatory and solvency point of view is the total of the technical provisions plus the capital on top, and it's that total amount of assets which is critical. Given that we have the regulators specifying the approach for technical provisions as part of Solvency II and ahead of IFRS 2, if we're ever going to achieve this ideal goal, it is critical that the Solvency II reserves are calculated on a realistic basis rather than a prudent basis. And there is obviously still time and opportunity for lobbying, as part of the QuizFi process. Now, if all the financial and regulatory reporting could be built around the same starting point in this way, it would enormously simplify things, substantially reduce the complexity and costs of financial and regulatory reporting, and then we could begin to repair the damage that I think we've done to the sector over the last 25 years as a result of having no single coherent and comprehensive reporting methodology. That's where I'd like to see us getting to. Thanks.
Can I ask a guest, William Hawkins, to be the next contributor?
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Cameron. I work as an equity analyst for Keith Burrett and Wood, specialising in insurers. As such, I represent one user of financial reports. Given that this is a recorded conference, I should be clear that my comments are personal ones, but I hope they reflect wider opinions of my colleagues and my clients. First of all, again, I'd obviously like to thank Cameron for his report. It's definitely a useful contribution to the debate from my perspective. I think there are three points that I'd like to highlight. First of all, I'd like to underscore your assertion that mark-to-market accounting has been questioned in some quarters. I'm afraid I'd like to go further and remove the mark-to-market prefix. Something is very wrong with the interplay between this industry's reported financials and its valuation in the capital markets. If I may just throw out a few numbers to make my point, if you look at some standard valuation metrics, and I appreciate I may be oversimplifying, but still, if you look at price to book, on an embedded value basis, the European insurance industry currently trades slightly below 1x if you average the large cap companies. On an IFRS basis, it trades slightly above 1x. If you look at the wider equity market as defined by the European 300, it's 1.6 times. If you take the similar multiples on a PE basis, we're looking at 6x, 9x, and 12x respectively. And I should emphasize there for the insurers, I've taken the average of the whole industry. Were you to X out the pure life companies or the life components, I would suggest the difference would be exaggerated. It would be greater. From this, I think you can draw two possible conclusions. The first one is that investors do not trust the numbers they're being given. The second one is that investors do not like the economics of the businesses, even if they do trust the numbers. Frankly, both of these are troubling points. But to the extent that the discount does reflect the former one, and my experience is that it probably does, it's inexcusable on the part of the industry and something that would be in the industry's best interest to address. I think Cameron's report is getting to the heart of this point, and if I may, it does actually get onto the very viability of the life insurance industry as an investable asset. Secondly, I personally believe that market-consistent techniques are valuable, and the industry is in a healthier place because of them, notwithstanding the many shortcomings that the report addresses. It seems to me that the legacy challenge for the life insurance industry relates to excessive ALM mismatches, be it related to equity exposure or duration mismatches, that were largely built up in a pre-market consistent world. Beyond the legacy issues, one problem that I see today is that too many business managers believe that market consistency is telling them not to take risk, especially with regards to markets. I do not believe this is the case. Market consistency should be helping business managers judge more correctly the value they are creating for a given risk. That point may be obvious to many people in this room, but I'm not convinced that it's so obvious to some of your peers in your companies. Finally, Cameron's presentation did not get on to something that was in his report, but I actually think is important to highlight, which is that presentation of financials is very important for users. In this regard, the interplay between cash and value is important. I think this interplay should include a clearer definition of what we mean by cash or surplus in a life company. This could become a more live debate during the implementation of Solvency II and the next IFRS for insurance contracts. Working on this problem may provide some insight into the issue of the liquidity premium. It could even make redundant the need to calculate one. Let's make sure we don't confuse the stock items of a company's financials with the flow items in this regard. If I may also digress onto another topic that Cameron touched on, the subject of own credit risk. I appreciate that from many rulemakers' perspective, this is something they want to avoid. And I personally also understand why a user of financials wants to avoid crediting a company for becoming less credit worthy. However, I also believe that in extreme environments, as we saw at the end of 2008, it's worth asking the question of whether it is truly market consistent to assume that the whole corporate market, as seen in the corporate bond market, is massively degraded, whilst an insurer's obligation to policyholders is as good as a government's, if not better. I think further work needs to be done on the validity of the liquidity liability put option in this respect. And maybe the question is more, how should this be presented, rather than should it be presented? Coming back to the subject of presentation, within Cameron's report, I think Table 6.2 is a very useful step forward with regards to demonstrating the difference between value and cash, but I would make two comments. It would be important from my perspective to be clear about what belongs to the shareholder and what does not. I also believe that presentation needs to make this industry more accessible, not more impenetrable. I do appreciate that these two points may be somewhat contradictory. Within presentation, I think it's important that financial disclosure should assist an investor model how figures are going to change over time. A complete black box that spits out unpredictable outcomes is unhelpful. If I may end on an afterthought, with regards to definition and language. When discussing the subject of embedded value, I am deeply uncomfortable with the use of the term real world, as often applied to embedded value calculations. I believe it is unhelpful because it draws a distinction and a contrast with market consistency in a way that I believe is inappropriately pejorative to the latter. I fear that some companies are moving towards a parallel presentation of what they call real-world and market-consistent embedded value in a way that may ultimately be self-defeating, partly because it adds another layer of confusion, another whole layer of reporting that we as investors do not need, and as analysts, I should say, do not need. But frankly, also, because I believe it's self-defeating in that it perpetuates what is potentially the myth in certain areas that life insurance is a capital-intensive, low ROE business. If you thought more clearly about where your market-consistent figures were at the end of 2008 and even today, I think many business managers would see it would be in their best interest to continue to focus on market consistency rather than to try to drop it currently and move back to the real-world environment. Those are some thoughts from my side. Thank you for listening.
James Harrison.
Thank you, Peter. Cameron, thanks for the paper and today's presentation. I'd like to continue along the theme of consistency and a common starting point. I've asked myself the following questions. What is an appropriate measure of profit? Will the IASB proposals deliver this? And can the Solvency II information help in any way? Now, arguably, there seem to be two perspectives at work here. The regulators tend to be primarily interested in the balance sheet, while investors tend to focus on the P&L. In particular, when it comes to profit measurement, there seem to be two general frameworks. The first of these is a balance sheet type approach, where profit is measured as the change in the balance sheet over the year, or the change in the equity. And secondly, we have a deferral and matching type of approach, where the P&L drives the balance sheet. Now, both the FASB and the IASB conceptual frameworks seem to have settled on a balance sheet approach for profit measurement. But where has the IASB exposure draft on insurance contracts ended up? Well, in my view, we seem to have a hybrid approach, where the profit is driven by the change in the balance sheet, but that balance sheet includes within its liabilities a residual margin, and the purpose of that residual margin is to defer profits over the life of the contract. Now, this residual margin exists because the IASB does not like the concept of recognizing profits at inception. However, this hybrid approach with the residual margin is likely to cause confusion for users of the accounts, and it also distorts the true underlying picture of the company. I do, however, have sympathy with the view of not recognizing profits at inception. I mean, what happens if things go wrong? How can you recoup dividends that you've paid out of profits that you recognized up front? However, and I think this is the vital point to understand, saying that you don't agree with recognizing profits at inception is just the reverse side of the coin to saying that you don't agree with a realistic value of the liabilities. So, for example, if you measure in your liabilities on a realistic basis, then your annual profit, measured as the change in the balance sheet, will automatically include recognition of those profits. Now, Solvency II, according to the Framework Directive, should be based on a realistic rather than a prudent assessment of the liabilities. So how can a regulatory regime, which is there for solvency purposes, effectively allow the upfront recognition of profits, while a true and fair accounting regime does not? Well, under Solvency II, the risk that these profits do not materialize is covered by the solvency capital requirement. What this means is that if we were to measure profit as the change in the Solvency II free surplus, rather than the change in the own funds, then the profits will merge in an appropriate manner over the time that the insurer is at risk, or at least as the insurer is released from risk and as the SCR gets released over time. So the SCR within Solvency II provides a mechanism to deal with the issue of upfront profit recognition, which is not available within IFRS. And it effectively means that we're back to distributable earnings. Hence, my belief is that if, and this is a rather large if at the moment, if we can rely on the Solvency II standard setters to do something sensible, so that the Solvency II balance sheet is on a purely realistic basis, with prudence allowed for via the solvency capital requirement, then the change in free surplus will provide us with a suitable measure of profit. And then if this is combined with an embedded value style analysis of movement in the free surplus, we will complete the picture. We can also then perhaps ignore the IFRS numbers that come out, although this would then seem a lot of hard work going to waste. Thank you.
Stuart Butler.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Cameron, for a detailed paper and clear presentation. I would just like to say a few words about this paper in relation to the current Solvency II test of Quiz 5. The paper is concentrated on a few key issues in Quiz 5, but as we can see by the length of the Quiz 5 question and answer document, there are obviously many more issues that are unresolved at this stage. And you might ask, why are there so many sort of questions unresolved at this late stage in the process? And one answer might be that insurers have been too busy to raise these issues beforehand. While some entities have clearly been very active in lobbying, there is anecdotal evidence that some others have not been able to spend as much time either analyzing the Quiz 5 specifications and the implications, or if they have analyzed them, they've perhaps not made the impacts of the various issues clear in the lobbying process. Some may have taken the view that certain areas which are uncertain under Quiz 5 may be treated as they are in the ICA world, but I'm not sure that that is such a safe assumption to make. I understand the FSA is taking some proactive steps in discussing Quiz 5 with insurers, and I would also like to reiterate some key points to encourage firms to lobby. Firstly, the EC is still drafting Level 2 implementing measures, so it is not too late to be heard. Quiz 5 will be very important in influencing Pillar 1 requirements, and perhaps one of the last opportunities to do so. Giving detailed feedback and suggestions, especially if supported with quantitative analysis, is a great way of influencing the debate. And there is much to defend in Quiz 5. If you agree with something, it's worth saying so. Just because something is in the Quiz 5 specifications now does not mean it will actually be in the final requirements. We saw with the Framework Directive last-minute changes to remove group support and add in an equity duration approach, and this was after intense lobbying from the industries. Finally, a multi-pronged campaign is generally more effective than just using a single point of contact. Companies can go through the ABI, the CEA, the CRO forum, but also through the group consultative or the actuarial profession. And this lobbying might not necessarily change the entire approach, perhaps as the paper envisages and hopes, but will go a long way to giving us a chance of getting what we want. Thanks.
Jim Collins.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Cameron. First, I'd like to say that I too think this was a very clearly written paper that brings the main issues into the open in a very effective way. My comments are more on practical matters than on technical ones and how these values are produced and used. One of the things that struck me looking at these issues, listening to the discussion, is it's not obvious how we're going to get a suitable level of consistency of approach in the various MCV measures that are being sought by various interested parties. An approach consistently that will foster a clear understanding of what the underlying messages are saying. Each requirement, Solvency II, MCV, IFRS, comes with its own very extensive set of rules. Does this make sense? The differences in some cases are quite subtle. In other cases, they're quite broad. In some cases, the rules seem to be arbitrary. It's a forcing a one-size-fits-all approach. Others, they seem to move away from a technically correct approach because that doesn't fit in with some objective or some objection. They certainly seem likely to increase the effort needed to prepare the figures disproportionately, and I think the scope for confusion is therefore quite considerable. I think the underlying purpose of a market-consistent valuation of assets and liabilities must be to help management to understand, on a best endeavours basis, the balance sheet and capital position of their business now and in the future, how this might be affected by changes in economic and other circumstances, and what else might need to be done to implement the chosen strategy for the business. Inevitably, the assumptions and techniques used will evolve over time, and management will need to understand this. But management also needs to understand, or also needs to have information provided in a clear, consistent manner, promptly and effectively. Now, if management understands the information, then it should be able to communicate these messages, or the messages that are relevant to their company, to other interested parties, shareholders, regulators, analysts, potential partners in an M&A deal, etc. And they should be able to communicate these messages effectively. Now, I don't want to belittle the need for some defined solvency standards, some defined accounting standards, or a defined way of expressing embedded value. But I feel that these should be measures and indicators that come out of management's assessment of their business and the business's needs, rather than being independent measures requiring separate, detailed calculations. I wonder whether more time spent interpreting performance based on a market-consistent measurement basis is more important than time spent adhering to detailed rules which may or may not be directly applicable to the business in question. So, question for Cameron. I'd be interested in your views, Cameron, as to whether it would be better to have a single set of key principles that set out how a market-consistent valuation might reasonably be carried out, with a requirement for companies to explain clearly to the relevant interested parties what these actual numbers mean, and to explain this in the context of a particular company so that the relevant parties can make their own interpretation as to what's been done in a way which meets their own requirements. And I think, to some extent, I'm echoing here what both Peter and William are saying to a certain degree. Would it be better to have a single consistent calculation of MCV for management based on a small number of rules and principles? And if everyone were comfortable for this, then perhaps the subtle differences in approach used for different purposes might be reduced. Could the profession or the industry lobby towards such an approach rather than going down the rules of many hundreds of pages of regulations that inevitably will cause more work, more expense, and ultimately we know that it's not going to be, or we know who it is who's going to be paying for this this cost. Is this something the profession should be advocating? Thank you.
I sourced the list of people who put their names down, so can I ask for other speakers, please? One change from now onwards is that if you could give your name when you start, please.
Yes, good evening. My name is Ryan Esson. I'm the chairman at the International Association of Insurance Supervisors of the Insurance Contract Subcommittee at the IIS. We are doing our very best to make recommendations to the ISB to minimize the differences between regulatory or supervisory accounting and general purpose accounting. To the extent that we can minimize those differences, that would be great. Now, I should mention that at the IIS, regulatory accounting does not necessarily mean Solvency II, but clearly there is significant input from European regulators into the subcommittee. The reason I came up, really, is actually to then switch my hat a moment. I'm also an employee of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners in the United States, so the US insurance regulators. And I wanted to mention that right at the moment there is an exposure draft put out by the Life Health Actuarial Task Force. It's called VM, Victor Mike 20. It's on the NAIC website at www.naic.org. which deals with principles-based reserving. And one of the key issues in there is the issue of the discount rate. In my position as chairman at the IIS, I think that this may be the most critical international issue to deal with when dealing with the exposure draft and also trying to minimize differences. The reason I bring up VM20 is to let you know that there are ideas in there that, although they start from a different starting point to Solvency II and what Cameron was talking about, nonetheless, I think have a lot of parallels. And I really wanted to mention to this audience that it exists and that comments from anywhere are accepted publicly at the NAIC on this exposure draft. So I commend it to you to take a look at it. It does start from a different starting point to the starting point here, but I'm not sure that it doesn't endeavour to get to something a little bit closer in the middle in the same way that Cameron was mentioning. Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Sorry, I'm Colin Keating. Just a couple of very short comments. I like the paper greatly, and I thought it was very, very readable. There's a couple of really fundamental problems with market-consistent embedded values and that whole series of approaches to the world, and with Solvency II. MCEV and Solvency II are both pro-cyclical. I mean, the easiest way to think of pro-cyclicality is to think of a pro-cyclical asset strategy. It's buy high, sell low. That's time inconsistent, which means that market-consistent embedded value and Solvency II are time inconsistent. Time inconsistency is a very poor way to run a business. The problems that you have, in particular with pro-cyclicality, which is where it's likely to hurt, is that restructuring won't work. Restructuring is about organizing or reorganizing the claims on assets. If you've got the assets, the policyholder's already been paid. So restructuring won't help you. So the only thing which is then available to you is recapitalization. In other words, inflows of new capital, new assets, in the depths of crisis. Well, you know two things about that. It's going to be very, very expensive, and it's going to be very, very hard to define the trigger event. I regret to say, I think that we probably have to go back to the drawing board and start rethinking this stuff from first principles.
Any other comments? Yes, Martin.
Martin White, I too found the paper relatively readable, although these days I work in non-life more than I do life. A few thoughts occurred as we went through. I am very nervous about believing much about market values. I'm not sure they tell us a great deal. If we look at the trend in the last few years and what's happened in banking, we had gains in market value, were recognised as earnings and distributed, and then they evaporated. And so balance sheets, which were partly driven by wishful thinking, drove reality and therefore subsequently problems. In Cameron's presentation, I was struck by his example of having a choice in certain market conditions between selling business at a loss and losing market share, and saying that was a nasty choice. But if the business really is at a loss, you shouldn't sell it. On the other hand, if it looks at a loss in terms of your accounting, but you really think it's making money, well, fine, you should do it. You might need to ask your shareholders for more money. But if you can't explain to shareholders why you need more money, you shouldn't be in the business. And I draw a distinction between business which is sufficiently matched that it doesn't really matter whether the market's closed down for 10 years in terms of trading financial instruments, and those which require them. I regard any business that requires financial instruments to work as not very sound. I think we've been running our economy on a lot of wishful thinking and imaginary security, which wasn't there. Reliance on the market, efficient market hypothesis. Would anybody like, who doesn't believe the efficient market hypothesis, put their hand up? Anyone who doesn't believe the efficient market hypothesis? Most people are not putting their hands up. I find that amazing. About the life business, I think, I'm not sure the life business has got a lot of future. I think the way it creates value for its policyholders is by extracting it from gullible savers. And post-RDR, I would like to see people being advised to buy protection and invest the difference. And that's, if you like, with a sort of public policy interest hat on. I think as a profession, we ought to be educating people to do the intelligent things, which in some ways is not using us.
Perhaps that's why companies are trading at such low multiples of embedded value. It's not the metrics that are wrong or the figures that are not believed, but the point you've just made. Anybody else? I've a couple of comments as we've got a bit of time. On the IASB's exposure draft, Cameron put up in one of his slides that there are three ways of calculating a risk margin, and only three, but whichever one you choose, you have to also give the implied confidence level. Now, I can understand the theory behind that, but I wonder how on earth the average life assurance company or even general insurance company is actually going to be able to do the calculations to answer that question if they have used a cost of capital approach to set the risk margin. So is it really a practical proposition? I'd be interested to know from the audience. And the other is the absence of any comment on the treatment of with-profit funds in the ISB's exposure draft, where one big difference between MCEV is that there is no requirement to split free assets between the shareholder element and the policyholder element. So all the work on burn-through costs, etc., which we've been doing for MCEV is not required for the published accounts, which seems a strange thing to me. Anyway, those are two little comments from me. I don't know whether they have stimulated any response. I'm not looking at anybody in particular, but if they haven't, I will hand over to Cameron, who is going to perhaps respond to some of the issues that have been raised.
Can you still hear me all okay? Thank you again, Peter, and thank you all very much for coming. I think the first thing I'd like to say is that although the audience I had in Cape Town back in March when I first presented this paper was much larger, there are clearly many more people in this room who have taken the time to read the paper in advance and prepare comments. And I'd like to thank you all for the time you spent in advance and at the meeting. Perhaps just to work through some general themes and then to move to specifics in a minute. I think we've heard of some general themes about the desire to only end up with one set of accounts, a meaningful, realistic set of accounts, and to really merge Solvency II, Phase II, and MCEV. I have long held that desire. I spend too much of my time talking about the differences and not enough of my time helping companies interpret the numbers and actually trying to think of the business case, which I find a much more interesting subject. My friends and colleagues and I, including Peter, have published a number of papers in the last few years commenting on these differences. But I will say to you all, in some respects, we're in the last chance saloon. No one mentioned this. I think this paper is quite timely, 6 months later, and it would have been too late. We probably have about a six-month window to speak to all the key parties and sort out Solvency II Level 2 implementing measures. Where they are currently will not, in my view, end up very helpful in many areas. There are plenty of areas where they'll end up very useful, but also a number of areas where there will be some significant issues. And for that, I'd like to thank Stuart for talking through the process of feeding back. And I would encourage you all to take the time after this meeting. By all means, read the paper if you haven't read it yet. I know most of you have. But please take the time to get in touch with your relevant organizations the people in your own organisations, and make sure you're lobbying on the key issues. I'd like to thank some of the guests tonight who took the time to come and provide comments. And if I turn to those comments in order they were given, I think William gave us some really good insights into what we should prioritize on. First, presenting the information in a clear way. It's something I didn't really feel I had time to talk on tonight. There is a table 6.2 in the paper. There is also a whole article in the Actuary July 2010 edition dedicated to table 6.2. I would encourage you to read that. Of course, the desire is that a lot of the information there will collapse away and go away if all accounting standards merge. Another point that William came up with is understanding what happens to the numbers in different environments. At the moment, I do not believe that any company out there is in a good position to be able to predict where their market consistent values will be at the next year end for a given set of financial circumstances. Too many things can change, yield curves can shift, and so on. And really, we must get to the stage quickly of stopping talking about the theory and starting designing systems to be able to give that information on a timely basis. Finally, I have a lot of sympathy with William's comments about real world. This is an unfortunate terminology which I take partial responsibility for in the early noughties. Market consistent values are as real world as real world values. Both give different perspectives. Personally, I think both are useful. I'll come to some of the other thoughts in a minute. One gives a useful about the value when benchmark against today's market values, but there's nothing to stop you thinking of a whole range of scenarios depending on what happens in the future. And that is also very useful information. There's nothing to stop you in your projection models deliberately bringing in some investment risk premia and seeing what does that do to the various measures. And in fact, a lot of the wider metrics that we talked about actually relies on that sort of information. I've heard a couple of speakers, and I totally understand where they're coming from, questioning the whole concept of market-consistent valuation. I can see why you would do that post-financial crisis. There is a certain element of pro-cyclicality introduced by market-consistent valuation. Now, I've done my best to mitigate that as far as possible in the paper. I've talked about all sorts of things you can do to stop exaggerating the level of pro-cyclicality, the weaknesses we have with current standards, and a number of things for various stakeholders to think about. For example, regulators being a bit more sympathetic in the capital requirements at times of extreme stress. That sort of flexibility we see in the current solvency regime around the world. My fear is that we may not see it in future solvency regimes. There is no need to be highly capitalized in all scenarios. That is why you hold capital. But the flip side is, I think companies need to take responsibility in benign times and stop messing with the accounts to try and generate short-term sort of spurious profits and actually hold enough capital in the benign times to cope with extreme circumstances. And I think, personally, the market system framework is a helpful tool to achieve that objective. There's been a lot of talk about how the market system valuation framework in itself might create pro-cyclicality and cause all sorts of problems. Well, we have seen various lessons from history in regimes where there is no market consistent valuation whatsoever of companies or entire industries running into large problems. Two examples I'd like to give today. First of all, the Japanese insurance industry in the late 1990s. Japanese insurance industry in those days, the accounting regulatory regime was heavily based on book value regime. We saw a lot of insurance companies in Japan at the height of the property market boom pile money into property and use that property to back annuity-style liabilities, long-term fixed liabilities, almost creating an extra boom in the property market. Of course, what happens when the property market turns around is that a huge proportion of the Japanese industry went bankrupt. You know, we talked about various measures insurance companies can achieve to meet the promises to policyholders. One of the things that I think it was Colin didn't mention is the fact that in extreme times, insurance companies are simply not able to meet promises to policyholders, and there are no capital providers out there willing to put money in unless unless there is some sort of bankruptcy or restructuring that effectively policyholders don't get their full guaranteed benefits. Many policyholders in Japan, many retired annuitants, many of those approaching retirement, had to accept significant reductions in the levels of their annuities. There is no market consistent regime there whatsoever. What about the AIG example? Now, AIG's accounting was famously not market consistent at all, neither was many insurance companies in America. In fact, AIG produced record and sort of very stable increasing profits year after year, I think for about 40 years. You know, I can't remember the exact detail, but say, for example, 10% increase in accounting profits year after year for 40 years. Now, does anyone actually believe that any insurance company can achieve such stable profits over time? Unfortunately, with AIG, we realized that they weren't able to achieve it going forwards. And these are examples where there is no market consistent regime whatsoever, and the insurance company or the insurance industry very quickly runs into trouble. Perhaps the market consistent regime may have thrown up some early warning signs there. Martin talked about how the entire life insurance industry is in a bit of trouble and is sort of questioning the business model. Well, first of all, there are certain aspects of the life insurance industry that I think should quite clearly be commended. The life insurance industry meets some very good needs of policyholders out there around the world, and particularly in the UK. For example, the term assurance product, other risk products, or even the annuity products. These are very sensible products designed for policyholders. I think one of the challenges life insurance faces is that often these products have to be sold. Policyholders need to be convinced of the value of the product, either through sales force or through taxation incentives. There are other products, sort of more savings related, where perhaps it's more questionable whether they are valuable. I personally think they have a good role to play, but I can see how a market consistent regime might start sort of threatening the capital viability of those products for the insurance industry. Again, I think the solution is, if the insurance industry thinks it's got a good model, hold more capital where it needs to, but also lobby governments, lobby others to introduce other aspects of, for example, in the tax regime, to encourage policyholders to buy those products. If it's such a good idea from a macro level, then I think we need macro solutions that falls outside any form of accounting. Turning briefly to James Harrison's requirements and putting my IFRS Working Party chair hat on, I can see where James is coming from. But I don't share the view that the need for IFRS numbers falls away. There are too many stakeholders out there that I believe rely on IFRS numbers as a starting point. Many outside users do not spend their time just looking at insurance company accounts. In fact, we're very lucky if they spend any of their time looking at insurance company accounts. And I think we as an industry have to get better at explaining IFRS numbers, both current phase one and future phase two. And that's where I think a number of companies have done very good work, falling somewhat outside the scope of this meeting, to put forward some IFRS supplementary information. And this is an area I would encourage actuaries to get more involved in. Please attend the Hot Topics session at the Life Convention if you're coming. Please do read more widely than just Solvency II. Please sort of try and sort of grapple with what is the philosophy behind these various frameworks, why are we seeing differences? And that I think, will help you lobby Solvency II to move closer to IFRS in many directions. I think one of the very good things about the exposure draft framework and the general philosophy of IFRS is it is much more of a principles-driven regime than we appear to be seeing Solvency II Level 2 implementing measures going. And there I'd like to agree with Jim Collins' advice that we start with principles, and we keep the guidance not necessarily as formal, as firm, and as mandated in all circumstances. I do think we need some sort of detailed guidance separately, which should generally be followed in most circumstances. And why is that? Well, unfortunately, because of what we've seen in the last 10 years where we didn't have guidance. I think it might be an ideal world to only have a principles-driven regime, but then I think we do see a myriad of approaches by companies. Companies not necessarily explaining things very well in the disclosures, or it's sort of quite hard to find for the outside user. You know, one of the things that some of my colleagues have done the last few years is look very closely at detailed publication disclosures and compare and contrast. It does take a lot of effort. I think this is effort beyond the resources of most stakeholders out there. So overall, thank you all very much for your comments. Please stay afterwards for drinks. And if anyone does have any further comments and they'd like to get in touch afterwards, my contact details are on the paper. Feel free to do so. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Well, I haven't got a gavel, but I still will declare the formal proceedings over.
Thank you.